from shaitan who has been cast away from God's kingdom of extra mercy. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. I seek the assistance of Allah, who is the absolute perfect being, to whom belong all the excellent attributes, principal amongst which are that He is Rahman, meaning that His love and mercy reach out to each and every particle of the universe, every moment of its existence. And His Rahim, meaning that His extra love and extra mercy is directed specifically to those amongst us who believe in Him and who follow His guidance. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. My deepest praise and gratitude is for all the beauty and for all the goodness that we see in the universe, from every actor of goodness, for every recipient of goodness. It belongs to God exclusively, because He's the master and the cherisher and the nourisher and the maintainer of the whole universe. وَالصَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَىٰ سَيِّدِنَا وَنَبِيِّنَا مُحَمَّدٍ. And our profound greetings on that greatest man who was the most humblest servant of all before God, and who therefore achieved the highest perfection, and on his holy progeny. Brethren in Islam, elders in Islam, Salamun Alaikum. My salutations on the scholars in our presence. And with their permission, I would like to share a few words with you. In my flight into Dar es Salaam in the Emirates Airlines, the November issue of the Emirates In-Flight magazine had an article written by Professor Stephen Hawking. He's supposed to be the greatest, so-called, the greatest scientist alive after Albert Einstein. And has written a famous book by the name of A Brief History of Time. He says in that article that in 1988, that's a decade ago, he wrote this book, and his aim was to make this book available at all the bookstalls in every airport in the world. So he contacted his literary agent in the Cambridge University Press, and he expressed this desire to him. The agent told him that it's not going to be possible. But he introduced him to some other agents, and one of the most popular publishers is Bantam. Bantam sent him Peter Guzzardi, who sat down with him, the editor, and he read through the draft, changed the draft of the book, made it more understandable and readable for the general public. The original title, Professor Hawking says, for the book was From the Big Bang to the Black Holes, A Short History of Time. Guzzardi suggested change the name, A Brief History of Time. Hawking admits he never expected his book to be so popular, yet when it was published 10 years ago, it remained in the Sunday Times bestseller list for 237 weeks. That's excluding the Bible, and excluding perhaps Shakespeare's plays, the most popular book ever to be read in history, according to Professor Hawking. It's translated in 40 languages throughout the world. For every 750 men, women and children in the world, there's one copy available of this book. Professor Hawking says, sometimes people come and tell me, you know, people just buy this book and leave it behind on their coffee table. They never read it seriously. But he says, I've received numerous mails come to me, and I've met many people who tell me they've thoroughly enjoyed the book. Some even asked me questions, some even raised doubts about the contents of the book. So he says, I know at least many people do read, if not the whole, at least part of the book. Well, the question is, Professor Hawking himself asks in this article, incidentally, the name of the article is An Even Briefer History of Time. Why is the book so popular? And he says, oh well, maybe one is the reason because he wanted to present cosmology and quantum theory and theoretical physics in a simple language to the layman. Secondly, he says, because the author himself, Professor Hawking, is a disabled person. At the age of 20, he suffered from motor neuron disease, which paralyzed him. Of course, he says, I don't want to call myself disabled. The politically correct word to use is I'm physically challenged. But this is the third reason why this book is popular. He says, I've tried to answer the big questions that face mankind. Where did we come from? How did the universe begin? What is the meaning and the design behind it all? He tries to offer an explanation. 20 years ago, he predicted that we'd be able to formulate a unified theory of everything, T-O-E, TOE, theory of everything. So far, it's not yet been produced, but he says perhaps in the next 20 years, we will be able to produce it. But look at his observation. The fact that his book is so popular that it could remain in the bestsellers list for 237 weeks, more than any other book in history. And the fact that it's translated in 40 languages, and the fact that for every 750 men, women, and children in the world, there's one copy available. The reason for popularity, he says, because mankind is faced with big questions to which it seeks answers. Hawking tried to give those answers. Fundamentally, the discussion yesterday we had was that mankind, at the end of the 20th century, has made tremendous progress in various fields. But despite all this progress, there are major problems. And the social critics call this the paradox of progress. And the reason for that is man is searching for meaning in life. Because he needs a solid sense of identity, one. Because he needs a philosophy of life, two. Because he needs a powerful vision about his future. We can realistically promise the fulfillment of his goals, three. And then we say that fasting, as legislated by the all-wise maker of the universe, was designed specifically for us to achieve taqwa. And taqwa guarantees, it gives us a solid sense of identity, one. It gives us a philosophy of life, two. And it provides us with a powerful vision about our future, three. I wish to go one step ahead. The ayah in the Quran, Surah Baqarah, chapter 2, ayah 183, God says, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, all those who believe. The same God who talked 1400 years ago is talking even today and will continue talking until the end of the world. And we say, Labbaik, yes my Lord. Kutiba alaykum as-siyam, I have legislated fasting for you. For the purpose that you may achieve taqwa and God consciousness. One of the aspects of God consciousness is our social responsibility. And fasting plays a role in providing that sense of social responsibility. Let me explain how. We have a hadith explaining to us that one of the reasons for fasting being legislated is a hadith by Imam Hussein, salamullah alayhi. There's a hadith by the 6th Imam, and by the 8th Imam, and by the 11th Imam. They all revolve around the same theme. So I'll just quote one of them, but the themes are the same. Fasting has been legislated. لِيَجِدَ الْغَنِيُّ مَسَّ الْجُوعَ فَيَمُنَّ عَلَى الْفَقِيرَ. Fasting has been legislated so that the rich may feel and experience the pang of hunger. So that he may feel compassion for the hungry, so that he may help the hungry. We may take it very lightly, but it is a very serious message in fasting about helping the poor and the hungry. We're living in a world where technological advancement has made so much riches available for us. Yet, the riches are not equally distributed. We have 25% of the population of the world, the rich north, enjoying 80% of the resources of the world. And we have 80% of the population of the world, the south, suffering with only 20% of the resources of the world. Now that's a serious problem, the direct result of which is you find there's higher levels of education in the north, higher standards of living in the north, longer life expectancies in the north, all the major research and development being done in the north. In contrast, in the south, there's poverty, there is hunger, there is starvation, there is disease, there is illiteracy, there is malnutrition, there is deprivation. As I speak to you today, even now, it's calculated that every 2 seconds a child is dying because of hunger. Every 2 seconds. Every day 35,000 people die because of starvation. There's 500 million people in the world who are starving. There's 1 billion people in the world who are living in absolute poverty. Robert McNamara, the past president of the World Bank, he defines absolute poverty. He says, then when there is a state in the human life, when there is malnutrition, when there is illiteracy, when there is disease, when there is a high infant mortality rate, when there is a low expectancy in life, when there is a state of life which is beneath any reasonable human decency, that's absolute poverty. We've got 1.5 billion people alive today who do not have access to health services. We have 2 billion people alive today who don't have access to dependable, clean, safe water sources. And yet there are riches available. There's a dangerous ethic that has developed in some of the minds of the rich, which says that, you see, the earth is just like a lifeboat. It's a spaceship, and we cannot tolerate many people on this spaceship. You know, in military medicine, there's a policy which is known as the triage, the lifeboat policy. That policy says that in the war field, when the wounded are brought to the military surgeon, there are 3 types of wounded people. There's one who has suffered minor wounds, which is just superficial. They're not life-threatening. There's a second type, which is suffering a major wounds, which is life-threatening. If you don't act, the soldier would die. And there's a third category, which is suffering massive wounds. Whatever you do, he will die. So the policy is, the one with the minor wound, just ignore him. Whatever you do, he's going to heal himself. The wounds are superficial. The one with the major wounds, he's in a life-threatening situation, you treat him. Otherwise, he would die. But the one with the massive wounds, you just don't have the resources to treat him. Leave him to die on his own. You can't do anything for him. The rich say, we can't help the poor. We just don't have the capacity. The lifeboat, the spaceship of the earth, cannot sustain all these people. So we ignore them. They die their natural death. You see, they say, the world is overpopulated. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were 1 billion people on earth. By 1950, half a century, there are 2 billion. Population doubled. By 1975, within a quarter of a century, the population doubled again. There were 4 billion. Toward the end of the millennium, they're expecting the population to go up to 6 billion. Imagine a community which has limited resources. Suddenly, in a span of 100 years' time, the population has not only doubled or tripled or quadrupled, it's come 6 times, 6 billion. We just don't have the resources, they claim. But the problem is there's a serious flaw in this argument. And that's where fasting comes in. Before I tell you about the flaw, let me quote what Mahatma Gandhi has said. Incidentally, if you scan and browse through the internet and just put in the word search, world hunger, that's where I got this information from anyway, you'd find an amazing array of statistics out there. Gandhi led the civil disobedience against the British colonials. And one of the weapons he used was the moral warfare he did against the British. And he won that moral warfare. And one of his weapons was fasting. It's interesting, this article says Gandhi did not believe so much in the theory, he believed more in the practice. We have very little about his sayings on fasting. This is one of the rare sayings he's got about fasting. Let me just quote. He says, this is in a letter written in 1926. He says, every religion of any importance appreciates the spiritual value of fasting. Now the important part. He says that, for one thing, to identify, to sympathize with the starving poor is a meaningless term. It's got no value. I sympathize, I have compassion, I'm sorry for the poor, I feel pity for them. Gandhi says that's a meaningless term. Unless you experience it. You know, President Clinton visited Africa? And when he reached West Africa, and he went to Rwanda, he apologized for the genocide that was committed there. In West Africa, he apologized for the slavery that took place. One of the black Americans wrote in Time magazine, Mr. Clinton, if you're really sorry, your sorry doesn't return our losses. Over a span of 100 or 200 years, millions of slaves were transported to America. Many died, many survived. If we are to expect that your apology is serious, then we expect you to pay back compensation for that. And he calculated. He says, for example, if you charge per day so many cents or so many dollars for the labor charges, and they were underpaid, the laborers there, or for so many million laborers, for so many years that they were enslaved, they deserve roughly about $200 or so billion now. And then you add to it another $200 billion because they suffered psychologically also. It wasn't only physical trauma. So we expect something like $400 or so billion from the United States government. For a government whose economy runs into trillions of dollars, that's not a big term. Mr. Clinton, we don't expect it immediately. You can spread it out over a couple of years in a variety of projects. The point is to feel sorry, to feel pity, to feel compassion for the poor, for the hungry, for the starving is not enough. It's important to experience it. Coming back to that objection, the world is overpopulated. We have to get rid of some. They have to die a natural death. The answer to that is the United States has only 6% of the population of the world, yet it uses 25% of the resources on the earth. A child who's born in the north will use up 40 times more resources than a child who's born in the south during its entire lifetime. You're telling us we're overpopulated? One of yours is using 40 times of one of ours. You see the problem? When you feast but you don't fast, you don't realize the true sense of misery that a poor man undergoes. And this is what the aid organizations in the United States are saying. Skip a lunch so that you can feed a bunch. We're talking about a lunch to feed a bunch. We're talking about a whole month of fasting. We experienced it. That's what our imams told us. The third imam and the sixth imam and the eighth imam and the 11th imam. Peace be upon them all. لِيَجِدَ الْغَنِيُّ مَسَّ الْجُوعَ He may experience the pang of hunger. لِيَرْحَمَ الْفَقِيرُ So may he sympathize and feel for the poor. Take another argument they make. We don't have enough supplies. The earth cannot sustain because there's not enough food to go around. It may be partly true if the earth cannot sustain and grow enough food and you cannot feed enough people, you need to cut down your population. But there's a problem with this argument. If you look at the mountains of food that Europe burns sometimes in the ears, the apples and the oranges and the peaches and the lemons, because they're excess, because Europe wants to maintain certain market prices. If you look at the amount of wastage that's done, look at the garbage that's produced and how much food is wasted in the West. If you look at the calculation, some have estimated that if you weighed all the people in the United States and Canada, you would find there are 100,000 tons overweight. you realize that there is no shortage of food. There is a wrong distribution of the food in the world. There's enough grain that the world produces by God's grace to provide 3,000 calories, which is the minimum for a healthy life for every man on the earth. And yet more than grains, there are beans, there are cereals, and there are fruits, and there are vegetables, and there's more. Yet, but it's wrongly distributed. And look at what God tells us. God never does injustice to mankind. It's mankind that does injustice to itself. In Surah Ali Imran, chapter 3, ayah number 117. In Surah Tawbah, chapter 9, ayah number 70. In Surah Yunus, chapter 10, ayah number 44. In Surah Nahl, chapter 16, ayah number 33. In Surah Ankabut, chapter 29, ayah number 40. And in Surah Rum, chapter 30, ayah number 9. In 6 verses, Allah is repeated again and again and again. God is not unjust. Mankind is unjust to itself. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَظْلِمُ النَّاسَ شَيْئًا وَلَكِنَّ النَّاسَ أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ. Take a third argument against poverty. We can't cure the problem. You see, these poor countries, they suffer drought and they suffer famine and they suffer floods. What can we do? When just a few months back, Nicaragua and El Salvador and Honduras suffered that severe hurricane and there was widespread devastation there, the United States and other rich countries, they provided aid in the form of $10, $20, $30 million. That's a huge amount on the face of it. But when you realize that the debt servicing that these three countries have to pay back, within a week they will pay more back to the United States. So it's not that floods are unexpected in Bangladesh. We know it will happen. It's not that we don't know sub-Saharan Africa will suffer the weather conditions of drought and famine. The question is the ability of these countries to protect themselves against these natural disasters. That is being undermined by the rich countries. When the same thing happens to the rich countries, they can defend themselves. The other argument, we can't help the poor. Remember, they are feasting and they're not fasting, and therefore there is that will is lacking. The argument I'm trying to make is the resources are available to mankind, but the resolve is lacking because we don't experience it. It's not that the means are not there to help the poor. The motivation is lacking. We're not experiencing their hunger. It's not that the situation is not clear. We know the solution to the problem, but we don't have that sentiment and that sense of responsibility to help. Fasting helps us to achieve that, provided, of course, we fast with the proper intention in the proper manner. One other objection. Oh, we can help the poor. We give them aid. There's a big problem with this aid racket. Number one, the United Nations says that to provide adequate aid to solve the problem of the poor countries, the rich countries have to use 0.7% of their GNP to help the poor. Yet right now, the rich countries are only spending 0.3%. So they're not giving enough aid in the first place. Secondly, the aid that they give, they don't give it equally to every country according to the needs of that country. United States pays $5 billion per annum between just two countries, Egypt and Israel. And that's equivalent to the total amount that's paid to the whole of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa. A person in Israel receives more than $600 per person per year from the United States, compared to the other countries where a poor man from America would receive only $30 per person per year. So true, aid is given, but not in enough amounts. And when it is given, it's not given properly. And when it is given even that little amount, it's not given to the right priorities. The priority is to give it for primary health care, for education, for fighting against diseases. Yet you find it being spent in projects which are of low priority. Number four, even when aid is given, most of it is given in terms of goods provided by the donor country. 75% of the aid that comes from Britain has to be in the form of British goods. And because there's no more competition in the market, the British will sell it more expensive to the recipient country. So the point is, it's not that the resources are not there. The rich countries have enough money to help, but the resources are not being used. There's no resolve. It's not that the means are not there. The motivation is not there. Our argument is, because the rich don't experience the pangs of hunger, they cannot really feel what's happening out there. The other argument against poverty, and these can be easily dispelled off if we accept the philosophy of fasting. They say that, oh well, we purchase goods that are exported from these poor countries, and therefore we're helping them. That's another baloney that they try to sell us. Calculations show, for example, Tanzania. If it's going to export coffee or cotton, the prices are not determined by Tanzania. They're determining the world market. The people who control the world market are the rich ones. A single piece of banana, just an example, a banana that's going to be sold in a rich country from a poor country. You know how much the banana picker is going to get? Just 1.5% of the total price. The farmer will get 5%. The other 5% will go to the fertilizers and the transportation. About 30 to 40% will go to the ripening factory in the local country. It will go to the shipment agency, and it will go for the red tape bureaucracy in the poor country. That's 50% of the price. The remaining 50%, 20% will be taken by the importer, 30% will be taken by the retailer and the wholesaler. The whole price of the banana that's paid by a consumer, ordinary consumer in the West, only less than 10% comes back to the farmer and the producer. You're talking about purchasing from the poor to help the poor? Most of the money is siphoned off elsewhere. The terms of trade. You see, after World War II, it was decided to build up the IMF and the World Bank, so that these two financial institutions will allow the free flow of money and the free flow of goods so that you can create wealth, so you can distribute wealth. But the creation and the distribution of wealth will be regulated, because unregulated trade prior to the world wars brought about poverty and instability and insecurity. You see, the tiger economies, Southeast Asia, Korea, Singapore, they became rich when there was a regulation in the market, when there was intervention from the government. The government invested heavily, they subsidized, they invested in education, they invested in health. They redistributed the major assets amongst the people. That's how the country came up. Right now, the structural adjustment programs that are told to us by IMF and the World Bank, there's deregulation of the market, there is breakdown of the trade barriers. And what happens in that case is the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. The philosophy is, as the rich will get richer, there will be a trickle-down effect down to the poor. The effect is the opposite. The rich keep on getting richer, and the poor keep on getting poorer. In 50 countries, the poorest people of the world are earning only 2% of the global income that's generated in the world. Only 2%. And that's the trickle-down effect for you. So we are told that we can't solve the problem of poverty. Our answer to that, there is a solution. The resources are there, but the resolve is missing. Fasting brings about that resolve because you experience what these people undergo. We say that the means are available to solve the problem of the world, but the motivation is lacking. Fasting helps us to achieve that. We say that the situation of the poverty in the world is clear. We know the solution. And the sentiment and the sense of responsibility to help comes about through fasting. In conclusion, I talked about the global situation, but we should start acting on a local level. We cannot expect to live in an island of prosperity surrounded by a sea of poverty. Nelson Mandela says that security for a few is insecurity for everyone. Let's pray to God to give us tawfiq, to be able to practice fasting in the proper manner, to achieve that real experience and compassion and sympathy for the hungry and the poor of the world. And let's have the strength to be able to share and care for them. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
النبي
الرجيم I seek the protection of Allah from Shaitan who has been cast away from God's kingdom of extra mercy. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم I begin this talk of mine seeking the help of Allah who is the absolute perfect being to whom belong all the excellent attributes principal amongst which are that he is Rahman meaning that his Rahmah and love and mercy reach out to each and every particle in the universe every moment of his existence and that he is Rahim meaning that his extra love and extra mercy is directed specifically to those amongst us who believe in him and who follow his guidance الحمد لله رب العالمين All my deep praise is exclusively for God and God alone because all beauty and all goodness from all actors of goodness to all recipients of goodness belongs entirely to Him because He is the Master and the Cherisher and the Nourisher and the Maintainer of the whole universe والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد And our profound greetings and salutations on the last prophet of Islam and the best prophet because he was the most humblest of all servants before God who submitted his will totally to the will of God and on his holy progeny. Brethren in Islam, elders in Islam, Salamun Alaikum. With my respect and honor to the ulama here, we were discussing about the main effect of fasting on our lives, and that is the achievement of taqwa. One of the aspects of taqwa that we need to implement in our lives is the ability to discipline and to control ourselves from all those lifestyles and all those behaviors which are detrimental to our spiritual health. Notice, we have been asked to fast for a few days only. In Surah Baqarah, chapter 2, ayah number 183, when God says you must fast, He doesn't specify initially how many days. In ayah number 184, He then says, أَيَّامًا مَعَدُودَاتٍ You should fast a few days only, not many days. And then in ayah number 185, He specifies, شَهْرُ رَمَضَانٍ Those few days in which you have to fast, it's the month of Ramadan. But why? He explains, because الَّذِي أُنزِلَ فِيهِ الْقُرْآنِ Because this holy month is so spiritually great that the Holy Prophet managed to elevate himself even higher. Though he was high, he went even higher to the extent that the whole of the Quran was revealed to him in this holy month on the night of Qadr. And the traditions tell us that even the past prophets received their holy books in the month of Ramadan. The Torah was sent down to Musa in the month of Ramadan. The Zabur and the Psalms were given to David, Prophet Dawood, in the month of Ramadan. Injil was revealed to Prophet Isa in the month of Ramadan. If we are to reform and bring ourselves under the guidance of the Quran, the best opportunity is the month of Ramadan. The Quran essentially is guidance for all mankind. Hudan linnas. It's guidance for all mankind. However, just like when the sunlight shines on the earth and the light and the energy and the heat reaches down on the earth, not all forms of life can benefit directly from the sunlight. It's only some forms of life that benefit. Specifically, the green plants, which possess chlorophylls, which can photosynthesize, that means they can trap the solar energy and convert it into chemical energy, which then becomes the basis of food for animals and for human beings. It literally sustains life on the earth. Sunlight is available to all, but only specific forms of life benefit from it. The guidance of Quran is available to all, but only specific groups of people can actually benefit. Surah Baqarah, the first ayah. ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ It is guidance, yes, but only for those who have taqwa, who have self-discipline, who have self-control, who have God consciousness in their lives. Interestingly enough, Ayatullah Jawadi Amuli, the famous mufassir of the Quran, he draws a conclusion from juxtaposition of these two verses together. The Quran is guidance for all mankind, for all human beings. Yet those who actually benefit from the Quran are the muttaqeen, implying that those people who are humans, but not muttaqeen, they're still immature. They're not complete human beings as yet. One of the aspects of being a complete human being and therefore being a muttaqi is the ability to control ourselves from all that is detrimental to our spiritual health. Look at Surah Luqman, chapter 31. Alif Lam Ra. Tilka ayatul kitab al-hakim. These are the verses of the Quran, of the book, which are full of wisdom, full of higher truths. If you follow these truths, you reach a successful life. Hudan wa rahmatan lil muhsinin. It's guidance, yes. It's mercy, yes. But only for those who are virtuous. That means they have practiced taqwa to an extent that virtue becomes the inseparable core of their personality. Hudan wa rahmatan lil muhsinin. Well, who are these people who are muhsin and therefore virtuous? Where ihsan is an inseparable part of their personality. الَّذِينَ يُقِيمُونَ الصَّلَاةَ 1 وَيُؤْتُونَ الزَّكَاةَ 2 وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ يُوقِنُونَ 3 They're the ones who constantly establish regular prayers. They're constantly in contact with the master and the cherisher and the maintainer of the universe. 1 They give out charity, zakat. Notice this surah was revealed in Mecca and talks about zakat. The spirit to help those who are in need is not only in the form of wajib zakat, but basically sharing out every extra provision that God has given us. And a muhsin has this virtue. That's 2. And 3. He enjoys a firm conviction, a powerful vision about his future. That there's an akhirah. This life is a lower life. There's a higher life available for me up ahead. He prepares constantly for that life. أُولَٰئِكَ عَلَىٰ هُدًى مِّن رَبِّهِمْ These are the ones who are the actually successful ones. وَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُفْلِحُونَ They are on the right path and they are prosperous. This is the description of taqwa. This is the description of those people who through fasting achieve taqwa, and these are the results. In contrast, the next ayah, Surah Luqman, ayah number 5, God says, وَمِنَ النَّاسِ مَنْ يَشْتَرِي لَهْوَ الْحَدِيثِ Amongst the people there are some who go out and purchase and make available for themselves لَهْو and hadith. Hadith, talk, stories, incidents, anecdotes, which are lahu, which are just amusing, which are just vain, they're idle, they've got no meaning behind it, they're just for time passing, they're just for time wasting. But these people just don't want to waste time. There's a purpose and there's a motive behind it. لِيُضِلَّ عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ So that they may obstruct, that they may distract, that they may prevent the message of God from reaching the people or from reaching themselves also. بِغَيْرِ عِلْمٍ And the bigger problem is the basis of these stories and the anecdotes. There is no logical proof behind it. Not only that, so not only do they purchase vain stories, not only do they do it to obstruct the spread of the message of God, not only do they do it out of ignorance and without any logical proof, وَيَتَّخِذَهَا هُزُوَا In fact, he makes mockery
He takes lightly the signs of God.
أُولَٰئِكَ لَهُمْ عَذَابٌ مُهِينٌ.
For such people, there is chastisement which is humiliating on the day of judgment.
Let me pause here for a little while. Let me just elaborate on this particular behavior.
It is said that at the time of the Prophet, there were some people like Nadr bin Harith, who in order to prevent and stop people from receiving the message of truth, when they went on trading to Persia, they brought back stories of romance of Rustam and Iskandar. When they brought it back, they gave it to the people, and the people started listening to the stories rather than listening to the word of God. Not only that, they started making mockery of the signs of God. In the Quran, God warns that if you disbelieve and if you act against the will of God, then one of the dangers is that you are creating for yourself in the next world food which is bitter and thorny.
إِنَّ شَجَرَةَ الزَّقُّومِ طَعَامُ الْأَثِيمِ.
Surely the tree of Zakum, whose fruits are bitter and which is thorny, this is the food for those people who reject the signs of God and who live a life of sin. So Abu Jahl comes and brings butter and dates. He says, this is the Zakum that this man is promising us. A mockery of the signs of God. For such people, the promise is chastisement. But when we come to the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, the Ahlul Bayt essentially, we should understand them to be those dignified personalities who had this firm conviction in God, who devoted and dedicated their whole life to the service and the worship of God. They became so humble, they became so submissive to God, that God elevated them. And part of the elevation and the extra favors that He gave them was the extra wisdom. And part of the wisdom that they shared with us, and they told us that, remember, these vain stories that this ayah is referring to, and it is so serious that there is chastisement for it, it includes music. This lahw al-hadith includes music. If you look at the edicts and the fatwa of the Muslim ulama, be it the Sunni ulama and be it the Shia ulama, there is unanimity about the prohibition of music in Islam. This is one of the verses. There are other verses, but let me confine myself to this one. If you look at the Ahl Sunnah also, Abu Hanifa clearly declares music to be haram. Malik, when he was asked, he says, يَفْعَلُهُ الْفُسَّاقُ. Only the transgressors against the will of God, they are the one who listen to music. When Ahmad bin Ibn Hanbal was asked about music, he said, يُنْبِتُ النِّفَاقُ. It brings about nifaq and hypocrisy and double standard of living and weakness in faith. And Shafi'i, the majority of the Muslims we have in Tanzania and East Africa follow Shafi'i faith. The Shafi'i, Imam of Shafi'i, says that the testimony of a person who listens to music is inadmissible. In fact, other sayings have quoted him to clearly say that music is prohibited. As far as the Ahl Sunnah is concerned, there is no doubt that music is haram. So also with the ulama of Shia, it is a unanimous fatwa that music is haram. This is as far as the verses go. When you come to the traditions, there is an even more elaborate explanation about music. Sheikh Tabarsi quotes a hadith from the Holy Prophet, and the Ahl Sunnah also have narrated this hadith in connection with this particular ayah that I just read, Surah Luqman, chapter 31, ayah number 5. The Prophet is reported to have said that ta'aleemul mughanniyat haram. To have a singer and to pay her, it's prohibited. One. Wa asmanuhunna haram. Wa aklu kasbiha haram. To earn through singers is haram. To profit from singers is haram. This is a clear hadith. There's another hadith which says, أَوَّلُ مَنْ تَغَنَّى إِبْلِيسِ. The first person who engaged in music was Iblis. The core identity of Iblis was that he was a rebel. God created him a good creature. He was a jinn. God gave him freedom. He abused that freedom. He became arrogant and he rejected and he was proud. The result of that was he started engaging in music. Essentially, anyone therefore who listens to music, basically is following that arrogant and selfish and proud pathway of transgressing against the law of God the way Iblis did. There's another hadith which says that Baytul Ghina La Tu'manu Fihi Al-Faji'a, a place where music is heard or practiced, you don't expect any security from affliction in that house. One. وَلَا تُجَابُ فِيهِ الدَّعْوَى. When those people they pray to God, God will not answer. The same God who's so near to us, who so much loves us, who knows our needs, yet when we pray to Him in our needs, He does not respond. The same God who's all loving and all knowing and all near and all kind does not respond. And thirdly, لَا تَدْخُلُهُ الْمَلَائِكَ. That house will never be visited by angels. Essentially, our soul is under the influence either of the positive spiritual realm, the realm of the angels, or then fill it with something positive. The hadith tells us a heart that is filled with music is not visited by angels. A heart that's devoid of the visitation of angels has no hope for success. Manjilisul ghina, another hadith. لَا يَنْظُرُ اللَّهُ إِلَيْهِمْ. God does not look at that gathering where there is music. God looks at everything basically, but His look is of two types. There's a general look because He's aware of everything. There's a special look where He gives favors. When He doesn't look at a gathering of music, there are no special favors and grace and blessings for that gathering. In conclusion, there is no doubt as far as the fatwa of the Muslim scholars are concerned, whether they are Sunni or Shia, as far as the verses of the Quran are concerned, as far as the traditions are concerned, there is no doubt that music is prohibited. Question, which type of music? You see, basically music has got a broad definition, which means any sound which is pleasant. Sound which is not pleasant is noise. Sound which is pleasant to the ear, that's music. But that's a broad definition of music. Music appears in many forms. There is the serious music and there is the entertaining music. The serious music you'll have in ceremonies. You can have a ceremony which is religious. You have church music, you have gospel music, you have mandir music. You have music on serious occasions like burial ceremonies, marriage ceremonies. You have music which is in non-religious ceremonies, sports, graduation ceremonies, military. You have music in work time. There's some people who get motivated if there's a background of music. Sailors, they like to sing. Incidentally, I came across even a situation where certain surgeons work better in surgery if there's a background of music. And then there's music in the social arena, music for relaxation. Basically, Western music, in fact, whether it's African, Asian, probably can be classified into two broad categories also. There's classical music. Western classical music includes the symphonies, the operas, the ballet dances. And then there is the pop music, the popular music. Popular music includes folk music, that's the farm music. And then there is country music, which is several different areas come together and produce country music. And then you have jazz music. Jazz is black African music, the black rhythm combined with the harmony of Western music, and you have jazz music. And then you have rock music, and then you have the rap music, and I don't know, it's still developing. There's a variety of music available. The question is, which type of music is haram? The answer is, our mujtahid and our ulama say, when we study the verses of the Quran and when we study the hadith, the conclusion we draw is that not all types of music are prohibited. Remember, I'm using music in the broad sense. Any sound which is pleasant is music. But there's only a specific type of music which is haram. It's that particular music which is engaged in by those people who perform evil acts. Look at the fatwa they give. صوت متناسب مع مجلس اللهو واللعب. The lahw, which is mentioned in this ayah of the Quran, Surah Luqman, chapter 31, ayah 5. Lahw, amusement, distraction, that takes you away from the message of God. That music is haram. That music which is sexually provocative, that which is exciting, that which is intoxicating, that which makes you want to move with it, that which makes you want to live that lifestyle, that type of music is the haram type. Let me elaborate a little further. You see, basically music has two basic components. You've got the message in the music and you've got the melody. The message is the lyric, the words. The melody is the tune. Now both of these things are important in determining which is haram and which is halal. The rhythm and the rhyme. The melody and the message. You can have a melody which is halal. You can have a muazzin who is reciting azan in beautiful sound. That's music. It's the halal type. Remember, I'm using music in a broad sense. You can have a person reciting marfiya, nawha, qasida. Beautiful sound. It's halal. The melody. But at the same time, you have music and melody where it's used for dancing, it's used for disco dancing, it's using to convey the message of alcohol or drugs or sex or whatever. That melody, just by listening to it, makes you want to move, excites people. That melody is the haram type. With this haram melody, if then you come and bring a positive message, that becomes haram also. You may read the Quran, you may read the Qasida, but if the melody is wrong, if the tune is wrong, if the rhythm is wrong, it becomes haram. Though the message is very good. Alternatively, you may have a very innocent rhythm, but the message can be devastating. That makes it haram also. Two factors therefore need to be kept in consideration: the melody and the message, the rhythm and the rhyme. There is no doubt that music has an effect on the listener. There is no doubt about it. Dr. Howard Hansen, in the Journal of American Psychiatry, he writes that music has this powerful effect of either invigorating a person or soothing down a person. It can ennoble a person or it can vulgarize a person. It can give you a philosophical message. It can be orgiastic also. You look at the famous singers and they'll tell you, Frank Zappa, I don't know if he was a movie director or what, but he realized the effect of music. He says, one of the most powerful tools for indoctrination. You want to bombard a message into someone? The bright lights and the loud sounds, you'll get your message across. Jimi Hendrix, a famous singer, I think he died of an overdose of drugs, if I'm not mistaken. And that's the problem with music. You come to believe what you sing, it kills you. And not only the listeners. Jimi Hendrix, he says, you know what, according to me, what music does? It makes the people go back to their natural state. He calls it natural, I call it the animal state. It makes people go back to their natural state, the pure positive state. Actually, it's the pure negative state. At that time, they reach their weakest point. At that time, you can transmit a message straight into their subconscious. Straight into their subconscious. You see, the problem with pop music, the music that is haram, is the messages that are conveyed across. Let me just give you an example. The House of Representatives in the United States Congress, they received a petition that we must stop certain types of music. And in their petition, these people say that, number one, we do not deny that music is a powerful influence in the lives of people in the past, present, and will remain so in the future. Number two, but we also believe that the messages conveyed through the medium of music are terribly negative. And they list down. They say there is invitation, there is advocation, and there is education, and there is encouragement for people to go for alcohol abuse, for abuse of drugs, invitation to bestiality, invitation to suicide, invitation to the degradation of women, of children, and family life. Extramarital sex is glorified. Forced sex and rape is glorified. Violence, sadism, masochism. Incidentally, the Friday prayer leader of Tehran after the Monica Lewinsky case, he made an interesting comment. He says, look at this president of the most powerful nation of the world. He's a sadist. Sadism and masochism advocated through music. Homicide, murder. It's amazing. If you look at the names of certain music groups, they are named according to the private parts of the human body. Some got names of sperm, some got... I can't name them, some of them. If you look at the titles, purely provocative sexual titles. If you look at the messages, the actual act of sex being described. If you look at women singers, clear invitation to the act of sex. Not only that, the worst part is, Professor John Stuessy is a professor of the theory of music in the University of Texas, San Antonio. He says, imagine a 15-year-old adolescent, a boy, listening to the messages of music. He's told that in a date you must have sex. Because if you don't have sex, then you're not a man. In fact, you're a wimp. And then when you do have sex, that sex has to be violent. And then he describes a few words that I cannot quote right now. Mrs. Tipper Gore, the wife of the Vice President of the United States of America, Al Gore, she's written a book, How to Raise a PG Child in an X-Rated Society. A society which is saturated with sexual stimuli all around in the surrounding. How do you raise a PG child, a parentally guided child, in an X-rated society? She says, what is worse than a female adolescent growing up in a society where she's going to meet boys who are given these messages about dates, dating and about sex in date? What is worse than that for such a girl? And then she answers the question, worse than that is the girl who's programmed to accept that sex. Violence, invitation to murder, invitation to drugs, invitation to alcohol, and all the wrong lifestyles. There is no doubt in our minds that the wise Lord, when He prohibited music, it was the wrong type of music, the music which gave us the wrong messages. Not only that, which has the wrong rhythms also. I wanted to quote a book written by American sociologist Alan Bloom. Professor Alan Bloom has written a book by the name of The Closing of the American Mind. He says, one problem with our society today is our young children are exposed to this particular music which appeals directly to their impulses. You see, when you listen to music, your brain is shut off. Your body is responding to the rhythms. And the rhythm the boys and the girls know it is the exact beat of the sex act. What parents tell the children that you should wait for the final gratification after marriage, music is providing them even before that. They don't even need to engage, Professor Bloom, they don't even need to engage in pornography. You don't need to be a voyeur to see others act. Through music, you do the act yourself. In conclusion, there should be no doubt in our minds that God in His all wisdom has legislated certain acts to be forbidden. And the primary reason for that is He wants us to become full and complete and spiritual human beings. And therefore, all those invitations to lifestyles which are negative should be avoided. Now the problem arises, what if I listen to a music and I'm not stimulated, I'm not excited, and I'm not intoxicated? I would like to offer an answer for you to think about. We're told alcohol is haram. And the hadith says, ما أسكر كثيره فقليله حرام. What is intoxicating in a large amount, alcohol, even a drop of it is haram. Let's pray to Allah to give us the tawfiq to be able to realize what is spiritually healthy for us and what is spiritually detrimental to us. And let's hope by the act of fasting we get that self-control to be able to say no to music. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. Assalamu alaykum. We are spending our precious moments in this holy month of Ramadan
which God out of His extra love and mercy has designed for the purpose of enabling us to achieve the state of taqwa. That state of God consciousness that brings about the character of virtue, which becomes embedded in our personality and whose effects then reach out in every aspect of our lives. Just to illustrate the different characteristics of a person who is God conscious, let me remind ourselves of the description given of such people in Surah Furqan chapter 25 toward the end, the last section, beginning from verse 63 onwards. وَعِبَادُ الرَّحْمَانِ. And you know who these God-conscious persons are? الَّذِينَ يَمْشُونَ عَلَى الْأَرْضِ هَوْنًا. Their way of life, their daytime activity is dominated by humility. They're humble servants of God. This God-consciousness, this awareness of the unlimited majesty of God overwhelms them, and they're humble in their lives. وَإِذَا خَاطَبَهُمُ الْجَاهِلُونَ قَالُوا سَلَامًا. And when they are insulted by those people who are ignorant, they punish this insult by being kind to such people. The second characteristic of the God-conscious people as described in the surah, وَالَّذِينَ يَبِيتُونَ لِرَبِّهِمْ سُجَّدًا وَقِيَامًا. That was the daytime activity. Their nighttime activity is they do not sleep in the late hours of the night. They express their total submission to their majestic Lord in the state of prostration, and they stand up in total obedience to that Lord. The third characteristic of these people as described in Surah Furqan, وَالَّذِينَ يَقُولُونَ رَبَّنَا اصْرِفْ عَنَّا عَذَابَ جَهَنَّمْ إِنَّ عَذَابَهَا كَانَ غَرَامًا إِنَّهَا سَاءَتْ مُسْتَقَرًّا وَمُقَامًا. O Lord, drive away from us the punishment of the fire of hell. The hell is the worst abode and the resting place for people. God-conscious people, they realize, look at the powerful vision they have. They realize that the punishment of Akhirah differs drastically from the punishment in the dunya. First of all, the intensity of the fire out there is much more than the dunya. Secondly, the separation of that fire, or the distance of that fire to the body which is going to be burnt, is going to be very small. Third of all, the sensitivity of the burning body to the fire is going to be much enhanced and increased. Third of all, the distance between the sensing organ and the brain is going to be very close. Fourth of all, burning is not going to take place from without only, it's going to take place from within. The very core of the personality of a sinner will burn from within, something we cannot even conceive and imagine in the dunya. رَبَّنَا اصْرِفْ عَنَّا عَذَابَ جَهَنَّمْ. This is the third characteristic of the God-conscious people. The fourth characteristic is, وَالَّذِينَ إِذَا أَنْفَقُوا. And when they spend, لَمْ يُسْرِفُوا. They are not extravagant, وَلَمْ يَقْتُرُوا. Nor are they miserly or niggardly. وَكَانَ بَيْنَ ذَلِكَ قَوَامًا. They are moderate in their expenditure and their consumption. The media which bombards them with the high standards of living and the invitation to a luxurious life does not affect them. They do not have this insatiable, unquenchable thirst for consumption which overwhelms them. They control themselves. The reason being, they have a powerful vision about their future. They know exactly where they are. They know where they came from. They know where they are going to. And that keeps them within the bounds of moderation. The fifth characteristic of the God-conscious people is, وَالَّذِينَ لَا يَدْعُونَ مَعَ اللَّهِ إِلَٰهًا آخَرًا. There are people who, in their belief system, they realize that this whole universe has been created by one all-powerful Lord, whose majesty extends all over, whose knowledge is unlimited, whose love is abundant. There is no reason for these people, therefore, to hope for anything good from anyone else other than Allah, and they fear of nothing other than God's displeasure, and they rely therefore totally on Him. The sixth characteristic is وَلَا يَقْتُلُونَ النَّفْسَ الَّتِي حَرَّمَ اللَّهُ إِلَّا بِالْحَقِّ. They respect life. They do not take somebody else's life. The sanctity of life, human life, is paramount. وَلَا يَزْنُونَ. And they don't make zina. They do not commit adultery. I'd like to pause for a little while here before I proceed to the next characteristic of the God-conscious people. Why would people want to commit adultery? Extramarital sex, sex apart from marriage? There are several possible reasons. I will just briefly point them out, and then you see how a God-conscious person can never fall prey to these factors. Some of the factors that facilitate adultery. Number one, we're living in a society where the atmosphere is saturated with sexually stimulating pictures. You look at the magazines, you look at the novels, you look at the movies, you look at the music, you look at the way people dress and behave. The flagrant, blatant display of indecency throughout. That's a possible facilitating factor for adultery. Secondly, the fact that this ethos, the fact that this idea and this value is being encouraged and advocated. If I'm not going to harm someone else, what's wrong in doing it? If I feel good, let's do it. The fact that, number three, the fact that facilitates adultery. Convenience. You find in societies, people don't want to commit adultery because they cannot. Maybe they're living in a flat or apartment which has got an extended family, so many relatives around, no privacy. Or they don't have access to a car that can remove them from their neighborhood and take them out to a place where they become anonymous. Nobody knows what they do and whom they meet and what they do with that person. Or they cannot afford to rent a hotel room. The moment a society becomes affluent, many of these opportunities become available. A fourth possible factor that facilitates adultery is this distorted thinking that comes in some people, in that they don't anticipate the consequences of their actions. The fact that after the action they'll feel guilty emotionally, the fact they'll wreck the relationship with the legal spouse, the fact that they can contract physical illnesses. In that moment of passion, the power to anticipate the consequences of their actions is gone. One other possible factor that can facilitate adultery is maybe they're not being satisfied in their marital relationship. Maybe they expect too much. Maybe their expectations have been fueled by these pornographic images that they see around in their society. When they expect too much, when they're emotionally unsatisfied, they may seek more outside. One other possible factor that can facilitate adultery is fantasy. According to surveys conducted in the United States, 95% of males and almost 50% of females engage in sexual fantasies. Sometimes these fantasies are so gratifying that they're even more powerful than pornography. In fact, when fantasies become frequent and when they become lustful, the effect shows itself in the behavior. But all these factors are just facilitating factors. They're not the cause of adultery. In Surah A'raf chapter 7 verse number 13, God says that when Shaitan was removed from the kingdom of extra mercy, he vowed and he promised. And he says, my agenda is, فَبِمَا أَغْوَيْتَنِي. Now that you've expelled me, لَأَقْعُدَنَّ لَهُمْ صِرَاطَكَ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ. I will most surely go and obstruct the movement of mankind on the straight path toward the Lord. ثُمَّ لَآتِيَنَّهُمْ مِنْ بَيْنِ أَيْدِيهِمْ وَمِنْ خَلْفِهِمْ وَعَنْ يَمِينِ أَيْمَانِهِمْ وَعَنْ شَمَائِلِهِمْ وَلَا تَجِدُ أَكْثَرَهُمْ شَاكِرِينَ. I will surely approach them and assault them and attack them from their front, Shaitan says.
and from their behind, and from their right, and from their left. And you know the result? You'll find the majority of the people will not be grateful. That means they will not acknowledge A, that they've got gifts from God and all this ni'mah. B, they will not recognize that you are the benevolent provider. C, they will not channel these gifts in the way that please you. They will not be grateful servants of God. That's true. Shaitan's agenda is there, but God answers Shaitan. Despite all your efforts, you must clearly understand. Surah Hijr, chapter 15, ayah number 42, God says, إِنَّ عِبَادِي لَيْسَ لَكَ عَلَيْهِمْ سُلْطَانٍ. My servants, you have no authority and control over them. إِلَّا مَنِ اتَّبَعَكَ. Of course, one who surrenders his will to you, oh, sure, you have control over him. إِلَّا مَنِ اتَّبَعَكَ مِنَ الْغَاوِينَ. Despite all facilitating factors for adultery, the final reason is the loss of control that man gives up. He surrenders to Shaitan. And therefore he is totally responsible, not these other factors. These are just facilitating factors. So the sixth characteristic of God-conscious people is they do not commit adultery. The seventh characteristic is وَلَا يَشْهَدُونَ الزُّورِ. They do not witness falsehood. وَإِذَا مَرُّوا بِاللَّغْوِ مَرُّوا كِرَامًا. And when they pass by, when they come across futility and vain things, they pass by honorably. They avoid it. They don't engage themselves in it. وَإِذَا مَرُّوا بِآيَاتِ رَبِّهِمْ لَمْ يَخِرُّوا عَلَيْهَا صُمًّا وَعُمْيَانًا. The other characteristic of these God-conscious people is when they're exposed to the signs of God, and the signs are plentiful, they're in creation, they're in the written form in the book. When they come across the signs of God, they do not fall off blindly. They do not fall off in deafness. They listen attentively. They think over it. They submit themselves. And finally, the final characteristic of these God-conscious people, وَالَّذِينَ يَقُولُونَ رَبَّنَا هَبْ لَنَا مِنْ أَزْوَاجِنَا وَذُرِّيَّاتِنَا قُرَّةَ أَعْيُنَ. O Lord, grant us solace, comfort, pleasure in our children and in our spouses. When you get children and family and a wife, and you can raise that family in an atmosphere of righteousness, that's the aspiration of these people. And finally, وَجْعَلْنَا لِلْمُتَّقِينَ إِمَامًا. They're in a state of competition, positive, healthy competition. They want to spiritually advance themselves to become leaders of all the other God-conscious people. Let me return back to our discussion on music, because there are some issues that have not yet been completed. وَلَا يَشْهَدُونَ الزُّورِ. One of the characteristics of the God-conscious people is they do not witness vain and falsehood. The Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, again, personalities who were holy, personalities who were totally submissive to their Lord. As a result of their piety and submissiveness, God raises them and grants them favor. And one of the favors He grants them is extra knowledge and wisdom. And part of that wisdom they share with us, and they told us that لَا يَشْهَدُونَ الزُّورِ refers to music also. In our previous talk we said that there is no doubt as far as the verses of the Quran are concerned that music is prohibited and haram. There's no doubt as far as the traditions are concerned. There's no doubt as far as the fatwa of the ulama of Ahlul Sunnah are concerned. There's no doubt as far as the fatwa of the ulama of Shia are concerned. I go one step ahead now. There's no doubt, in fact, even as far as the fatwa, so to speak, fatwa of the medical experts is concerned. Consider the reports that I'm going to just narrate to you. The Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, 1989 edition, September issue. There's an article written by Elizabeth Brown and William Hendy. And the title of that article is Adolescents and Their Music, Insights into Adolescent Health. They report
that 7th graders up till 12th graders in the United States listen to about 10,500 hours of music. This time period is just a little less than the total amount of class hours that a student would spend from kindergarten up till he finishes school. Look at the vast exposure to music, one. Two, consider the second fact. When a sampling was done of music television videos, MTV, it was found that almost 60% of them contained content analysis. About 200 video programs were checked for content analysis. They were found that almost 60% contained sexual themes. Almost 80% contained violent themes. And of those that contained violent themes, sorry, of those that contained sexual themes, majority of them were violent sexual themes. Half of them showed half-naked women. Consider the third fact. When a group of adolescents was shown a sampling of these videos, and another group of adolescents was not shown the sampling of videos, and then this group which was shown was asked about their opinion and readiness to engage in premarital sex, sex before marriage, this group was ready. If there's any doubt in anyone's mind that music does not affect, look at the opinions of these children. Take the fourth fact into consideration. Student counselors who meet a large number of students, they say, we come across children who are so much influenced by music that the way they talk, their vocabulary, the way they behave, the way they dress, the stickers they use on their books, the posters they hang on their walls, the music they listen to their cars, all reflect that these people are imitating their music heroes and stars. If there's any doubt in anyone's mind, music does not affect, how do you explain these facts? Look at the fifth fact. Dr. Paul King is an assistant professor of child and adolescent psychiatry. In a report that was printed in Postgraduate Medicine, 1988, April, he says those patients, the children or the adolescents who were admitted for drug abuse, we found that almost 50% were engaged in stealing. 60% were engaged in sex. Almost about 70% were in drug use. Almost 80% were engaged in violence. If there is any doubt in anyone's mind that music has no effect, how do you explain these statistics? Essentially, the effect of music on man cannot be denied. Let me recapitulate some of the reasons why, therefore, Islam has prohibited certain types of music. But before I recapitulate, let me just add one more mas'ala, which I did not have time to discuss in the previous discussion. I said that in order to judge which music is halal and which is haram, you take two factors into consideration. Number one is the message. Number two is the melody. There's a third factor, the musical instrument. Musical instruments can be classified into five major classes. Number one, you've got the stringed instruments. Stringed instruments can be subclassified into two subclasses. There's a stringed instrument which has the bow like the violin. There's a stringed instrument which is plucked by the finger or the pick like the guitar. The second class of musical instruments are the wind instruments. The wind instruments are subclassified again into brass instruments. That means you have the tuba, the trombone, the trumpet. The second subclass of wind instruments are the windwood instruments. That means you have the piccolo, the flute, the saxophone, the cello. The third class of musical instruments are the percussion instruments, the drums, the bongo drum, the kettle drum, the cymbal, the gong. The fourth class of musical instruments are the keyboard instruments. You have the piano, the harpsichord. The fifth class of musical instruments are the electronic musical instruments. That means you have the electrical guitar or you have the music synthesizers, the computerized music synthesizers. You have a wide variety of musical instruments available. Question, when we are to judge which music is halal, which music is haram, criteria number one is check the message. Criteria number two, check the melody. Criteria number three, check the musical instrument that's being used. If there is a musical instrument, don't ask me which. If there is a musical instrument which is exclusively used only for haram purposes, then even if you listen to it just for halal purposes, it's still haram. But if there's a musical instrument which has dual purpose, it can be used for both halal and haram. When you listen it for halal purposes, it's halal. When you listen it for haram purposes, it's haram. When Ayatollah Al-Uzma Sistani, may Allah prolong his services for the Ummah, was asked about which music therefore can be considered halal, the examples he gave were music in the funeral ceremonies, for example, military music, soothing music, classical music. Again, keep in mind, the message, the melody, and the musical instruments have all to be for halal purposes. There's one type of music which has been made as an exception. Marhum Ayatullah Al-Uzma Sayyid Abu Al-Qasim Al-Khoi, may Allah raise the station. He said that if women sing on marriage ceremonies, then that is allowed, provided four conditions are fulfilled. Condition number one, the message in the music should not be haram. Condition number two, the musical instrument that's being used should not be haram. Condition number three, there should be no mixed gathering. Condition number four, the melodious tune in which she sings should not be sexually provocative. Ayatollah Al-Uzma Sistani makes ishkal on this fatwa of Ayatollah Khoi. That means ihtiyat wajib, according to him, you have to even avoid this singing of women in marriage ceremonies with these four conditions. Let me come back to the discussion on recapitulating, therefore, the main reasons why we consider music to be haram. Number one, because it has got a morally depraving message and influence on us. Number two, because sometimes it clearly leads us away from God. The very agenda of these singers is to take us away from God. I'm sorry I have to take these examples, but then these examples are something we come across. Madonna. Chiconi Madonna was born in Bay City, Michigan. She came from a Catholic family. She was educated by nuns, yet she rebelled against religion. And the manner in which she rebelled, she said that she believes that Catholicism separated spirituality and sexuality. According to her, sex and spirit go together. And therefore she comes out in sexually provocative dresses inside the church, across the altar. She carries out sexual acts to say and to declare to the world, according to her, sensuality and spirituality are not separate. In another promotional video, she comes flagrantly against religion. Of course, it's the Christian religion, but nevertheless, we share some basic beliefs with the Christian religion also, and some basic values. She comes out in front of an animated statue of a saint and carries out that forbidden act. And there are crosses, the Christian cross, the crucifix burning in the background. And she was asked why this disrespect. She says it wasn't disrespect, this is a symbol. The cross burning, according to me, I'm fighting against racism. I'm fighting against the Ku Klux Klan. Which is a white supremacist, racist group in the United States that wants to wash away all the black Americans away from the United States. And when she came to Rome and the Vatican objected to her concert tour, she said, she told the Vatican, if you think I am a sinner, then let the one who did not commit sin cast the first stone. And she tells the Vatican, come and see my show. I've got a message. Mine is a theatrical presentation. All theatrical presentations are thought-provoking. I want to take you through an emotional journey. An emotional journey she took them across was having the forbidden act with the saint. So the second reason why we say music is haram, because sometimes there are clear messages against God, against the values of God, against religion per se. The third reason, there's no doubt that music has a seductive effect. The psychologist John Kappas, when he made research into concerts, remember concerts, the classical Western music, he found out that people's psychological state when they came out from concerts were they were in a hyper-suggestible state. They were susceptible, they were gullible, they were recipient, they were now ready to receive whatever message you want to give them. Their inhibitions go down. These are observed effects. A fourth possible reason why music is considered haram is because even those soothing music, the apparently innocuous, harmless music, just the fact that it's got a repetitive rhythm, just the fact that it is energetic, just the fact that it has got this melody, it alters our consciousness to a certain degree that makes us then ready to behave according to the messages that we get across from them. And finally, the musician basically transmits to you part of his consciousness. What he does is he influences us in such a way that once in our consciousness our inhibitions are down, we readily listen to him and accept him. Elvis Presley, known as the king of rock music in the United States, the most celebrated singer in the history of the United States, when he came on stage, the manner of the bodily movements, the provocative manner in which he moved his body, were offensive to the church. When he was interviewed, he said, "You know what happens when I go to the stage? I don't know what overcomes me. Something else is moving me." Well, we know what's moving him. Man asgha, look at the hadith, man asgha ila natiqin faqad abada. Whosoever listens attentively such that his consciousness blends with the consciousness of the speaker. Man asgha ila natiqin faqad abada. It's as if he worships him. فَإِنْ كَانَ النَّاطِقُ عَنِ اللَّهِ فَقَدْ عَبَدَ اللَّهِ. If the speaker represents the word of God, then you're worshipping God. وَإِنْ كَانَ النَّاطِقُ عَنِ الشَّيْطَانِ فَقَدْ عَبَدَ الشَّيْطَانِ. And if the speaker represents the word of God, word of Satan, Presley didn't know what was moving him, or we know what was moving him, then we are worshipping Shaitan through that process. Let me go further. Presley was raised again in a religious background. In Memphis, Tennessee, when he moved in the 50s, he used to attend the church, the Assemblies of God. The Assemblies of God believed that in order to worship God, you should allow the Holy Spirit to come into you and to rule over you. And the Holy Spirit will make you want to pray, make you want to dance, want to sing out, want to wail, want to cry. What these singers did is they took this concept, sacred concept, and they secularized it. They took the godly message and they brought Satan into it. The pastor, Reverend James Hamill, when he was interviewed, he was a pastor in which Elvis Presley used to attend. He says, "Once in the 50s, Presley came to me, and after a Sunday night service, he admitted to me, 'Pastor, I'm the most miserable man you'll ever come across in the world.'" Presley admitted that he had all the finances and money he wanted. He had millions of fans listening to him. He had friends in the high places. He could do whatever he wants. "But Pastor," he told Reverend James Hamill, "the problem is what you taught, what you were teaching and what you were preaching, what you taught us, I'm not acting on it. What you taught us not to do, I'm acting on it. And I know I'm doing something wrong, but I just cannot control myself." Look at the misery this man was undergoing. So basically, we believe that a God-conscious person is one who is totally in control of himself. Fasting achieves that control for man, whereby he can then resist all these temptations of Shaitan. Let's pray to God to give us the tawfiq to be able to realize our godly duties and then to have the strength through fasting to implement those duties. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.